The stories we tell matter. The stories that we choose to tell can be used to empower ourselves and others, or they can be used to belittle and diminish. The stories we choose to tell can inspire us, expanding our minds, opening our hearts, or they can instill fear, scapegoating, and demonizing others. And when I say that the stories that we choose to tell matter, I use that word choose intentionally, because we can choose to tell a different story than the one we have inherited or have learned to tell about ourselves, about others, and about this world. Byron Katie is a contemporary spiritual teacher. Do any of you know her work or have read a few? Okay, quite a few. I've only read some of the basic materials about Katie, and it's been quite a few years ago, but her basic framework has stuck with me for whatever reason, perhaps because it's such a simple, straightforward, practical method for questioning the validity and helpfulness of the stories that we have learned to tell ourselves. Katie has designed what she calls a one-page Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. Now, that may be the leading contender for best beginning to a spiritual practice that I've ever heard, the Judge Your Neighbor worksheet. That's easy for most of us. It invites you to reflect on a stressful situation in your life, and then it walks you through writing kind of a Mad Lib style of writing, you know, name of person, name the emotion, name the place. So it kind of walks you through writing six simple sentences about that stressful situation in response to prompts like who angers, confuses, or disappoints you and why, and how do you want or think you want that other person or yourself in this situation to change. And these six statements help you identify some of that story that you've learned to tell in regard to this stressful situation about yourself and others in the world. And once you've generated those six simple statements about your stressful situation, you get to the heart of what Katie calls the work, in which you investigate the truth of those six simple statements using four questions. Is it true? Can you absolutely know that it's true? How do you react whenever this thing happens and when you believe this thought that you think is true? And four, who would you be without that thought? And I hear that question is asking, what might change if you started telling a different story about yourself, about others, about the world? And the final part of her method has the greatest potential for transformation. For each of those six statements, she then challenges you to experiment with reversing your thought, and then find at least three specific, genuine examples of how each turnaround, how each thought reversal is actually true for you in this situation. Here's one example she gives. If the story you've been telling yourself is that Paul just does not listen to me about his health, and that's the story you've been telling yourself, you've been telling your coworkers, it's that story you've been rehearsing over and over, then despite all the ways in which that story is true, Katie's method might invite you to consider all the ways in which that is at best a limited version of the truth. So turning around the story, Paul doesn't listen to me about his health, you turn it around first in regard to yourself. How might there also be a truth of, I don't listen to myself about my health? Or turning it around in regard to the other, I don't listen to Paul about his health. Or returning it around to the exact opposite, Paul does actually listen to me about his health sometimes. The stories we choose to tell matter. Yes, there may be truth in the story that Paul doesn't listen to me about his health, but is that the best or the only or the most helpful story to tell? Why are you fixating on telling that story over and over? And how might that story be helping you avoid telling a story such as, I don't listen to myself about my health? Or how might that story be preventing you from hearing competing narratives? I don't listen to Paul about his health. Or Paul sometimes does listen to me about his health. Now, I think you can probably pretty quickly think of analogies in your own life. The stories we choose to tell, that we choose to tell, matter. I remember in the Southern Baptist Church of my childhood, not long after I had been baptized at age 10, there was an important congregational vote. Although I was young, I was able to cast a ballot because they went ahead and baptized me, making me a member of the congregation. This was in the late 1980s. It was in the Midlands of South Carolina toward the end of the Reagan Revolution in American politics. And the flashpoint in that election in my congregation was the first time in my congregation's history. This was like an 800-member, big steeple, Southern Baptist congregation. It was the first time in my congregation's history that a woman had been nominated to serve as a deacon. I don't recall hearing anything about the controversy leading up to the vote. That's probably because I was 10 and wasn't paying attention. And I was a child care volunteer that Sunday, so I wasn't in the main worship service for the vote at the end. But they brought down ballots for the child care workers, most of whom were adults, but some of whom were youth. And I remember people discussing whether that morning whether it was okay to be a female deacon or not. And I remember thinking, why wouldn't women be able to be deacons? So I voted for her. The good news is that she won. The bad news is that was probably the peak of liberal progress in that congregation, which is a sordid tale that I will not tell you this morning. The point for this morning is that as a 10-year-old boy growing up, even in a Southern Baptist congregation, even in South Carolina, the stories that had shaped me, despite the ministerial staff being all white males, were of the strong women who had raised me, who I saw constantly organizing congregational dinners, who were teaching me Sunday school, and maybe that's why I'd never heard some of those things about women not supposed to be deacons. Maybe it's because all my teachers, most of them were women. That's a conspiracy I could get behind. What I'd seen were that all these women, that was the story I'd learned to tell, was of all these women who were vital backbones of the congregation. So when I overheard the discussion of whether a woman should be allowed to be a deacon, I just didn't understand at that time the historical import of the question, because I hadn't yet learned, for example, all those parts of the Apostle Paul's story in which he allegedly says things like women should be silent in church. Maybe I hadn't heard those stories because, let me say it this way. Besides, I know now that in all likelihood those words were falsely attributed to Paul and that the historical Paul was more of a mystic than a misogynist. Maybe I'll someday get around to preaching a Mother's Day sermon called Our Mother, St. Paul. I'm actually not kidding. There's a lot. We actually emphasize the negative on Paul, and it's there. But that's also part of the stories that we choose to tell. For now, my point is that no one is born a sexist or a homophobe any more than someone is born a racist. As the lyrics from South Pacific go, you've got to be carefully taught. And that gets into the stories that we tell and repeat. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people that your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. Hate isn't natural. It's a choice. The stories that we tell matter. And it's an honor this morning to tell you some of the story of Margaret Fuller. I won't get to anywhere near all of it, but I'd like to tell you some. I can't recall ever hearing her name growing up, but she's now one of my favorite founding mothers of our movement. And if you find yourself curious to learn more about her, a great starting point is Megan Marshall's recent biography titled Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. Have any of you already read that? It just came out in 2013. I decided to read it when I saw that this book about a Unitarian woman in the 19th century had made the New York Times list of 100 notable books in 2003, and I heard just a few weeks ago that Marshall's biography of Fuller won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in the autobiography category. Now, if you've not heard of Fuller previously or didn't know much about her, that's really both understandable and testament to the male bias in how history, our stories, have often been told. And Marshall herself first became fascinated with Margaret Fuller through a women's history class at Harvard. Women's history, or what we should learn to start calling history, told in a better, egalitarian, more inclusive sense. And in an interview after she won the Pulitzer, Marshall said, "I thought of Fuller as very famous, but when I told people that I was working on this biography about Margaret Fuller, I kept getting these blank looks. And I felt it was an absolute tragedy if people did not know about her." And as much as I loved reading Marshall's one volume even though it's 500 pages about Fuller, I'm now eager to read Charles Capper's two-volume treatment of Fuller through Oxford University Press, which weighs in at more than 1,000 pages. There's that much to say about her easily. And perhaps I'll preach another sermon about Fuller in a few years as I continue to learn more about her. How many of you learned about Fuller growing up? Okay, so a few. How many of you never heard about Fuller before, like last week when I mentioned her? Yeah, okay. Capper writes, "When I began researching my biography of Margaret Fuller, she had virtually vanished from history. Her work had been out of print for 75 years. Her papers were hidden away in archives. She rarely appeared in dissertations or monographs. What a difference a few decades makes. She is now grouped with Emerson and Thoreau as one of the big transcendentalist three. She's the focus every year of whole chapters and dozens of dissertations and monographs. The difference, of course, was second wave feminism in the 60s and the 70s, which helped begin to retrieve those unduly and unjustly lost stories of many female activists and innovators and leaders, which had been too long neglected. In 2010, the 200th anniversary of Margaret Fuller's birth was widely celebrated. Fuller was born, as you heard earlier from Laura, in 1810. Her father, Timothy Fuller, could have given Tiger Mom Amy Chua a run for her money as far as aggressive parenting of gifted children. Timothy expected as near perfection as possible and had absolutely no patience for mistakes. Himself a Harvard graduate, Timothy started teaching Margaret Latin at age 6. And required that she stay awake until he came home from work so he could supervise her, repeating back to him everything she had learned that day. Margaret was raised not on Bible stories, but on the classic Greek and Roman myths, which would come to serve her well. I'll get to that. And to give just one more example of her early education, at age 15, her custom was reading French and Latin on her own for several hours each day, morning classes in Greek, along with metaphysics, piano practice, regular walks, and evening journal writing. There are 6 volumes of her letters from her lifetime. In her free time, even as a young child, she preferred the more active rough and tumble games of boys and described herself as a child of masculine energies. Today, of course, increasing numbers of people recognize that gender is a spectrum. But Margaret lived in the first half of the 19th century, an age of men in suits and women in puffy sleeves and corsets. To be frank, the trajectory that Margaret was expected to follow in her life was essentially to earn an MRS degree, marry well, and see that marrying well as her sole achievement and height of achievement in her life. In contrast, her rigorous childhood education and her natural aptitude encouraged her to want to continue competing with those boys that she loved to play chase and other active games with. But the societal attitude towards females meant that as her male childhood playmates went off to Harvard, she found herself expected to tutor her young siblings. And although denied the place that she should have had as part of Harvard's class of 1829, she did get permission to use the Harvard Library to research her first book and did not allow the gawking undergraduates who had never before seen a woman working in their midst to break her concentration. That book, Summer on the Lake, sold better than Emerson's first book, Nature. You may have heard of it. In 1836, through her friendship with Ralph Waldo Emerson, Fuller was one of the first, the few select females invited to participate in what was known as the Transcendental Club, a meeting of like-minded intellectuals who helped birth the transcendentalist movement in this country, which was influenced by an emphasis on individual spirituality over institutionalized religion, romanticism, as well as the Eastern religion, so starting to translate Buddhist sutras and starting to read the Bhagavad Gita. And when the Transcendental Club started a journal called The Dial as a platform to promote its views, Fuller volunteered to be the editor, and Emerson seconded her self-nomination. Through her position at The Dial, Fuller became the 23-year-old Henry David Thoreau's first editor, and although she accepted one of the first poems he submitted for publication, she wrote in a rejection letter that she hoped to publish his essay eventually, but while it was rich in thought, in its present form, those thoughts seemed to me so out of their natural order that I cannot read through it without pain. She didn't hold back. Margaret also used The Dial as a platform to promote women's equality. And in 1939, she began hosting a series of weekly conversations in Boston in which women were invited to gather in a circle and engage in open conversation about the great questions. What were we born to do, and how shall we do it? And they were invited to freely state both their doubts and their difficulties. And as a basis for these congregations, she drew on her classical childhood education, stories of Greek and Roman vitality rather than parables, as she saw it, of Christian piety and submission. Margaret took a similar approach earlier as a teacher. She wanted other women to know the story of Arachne, that ambitious young woman, where we get arachnophobia, right? The story of Arachne, that ambitious young woman who wanted to weave as fine as the goddess Minerva, as well as the stories of Daphne, Aspasia, Sappho, and Diotomia. She required reading by female authors, and when reading Wordsworth, she singled out his poems about women. Margaret's hope in her new venture of conversations was to help women in Boston experience for themselves the power of that freewheeling open discussion that she had found so liberating as a member of the Transcendental Club. And she wrote that she hoped to bring women together undefended by rouge or candlelight, to dispense with the pointless artificial conventions of female parlor chat, digressing into personalities or the commonplace, in a word, gossip, and require instead a simple, clear effort for expression. What do you really think about these great questions? And just as she had been drawn to those rough and tumble boys' games as a child, as an adult, she wanted women to join her in experiencing the heights of intellectual stimulation that some thought only men were capable of. And soon, 25 women had bought $10 tickets to an initial 13-week series, a rate of pay about two-thirds of Waldo Emerson's take for a similar course of lectures. I don't have time to get into it here, but we talked in the spoken meditation about some of the difficulties these forebears had. She had serious financial difficulties throughout her life, including some terrible decisions made by her father that she then suffered from. When asked about focusing her conversations more on the abolition of slavery, remember that we're 20 years before the Civil War at this point, she replied, "The abolition cause commands my respect, as do all efforts to relieve and raise suffering human nature." But her particular interest was expanding the abolition movement from the enfranchisement of African only, which came in 1870 with the 15th Amendment, to include women's suffrage. It's the same thing that Sojourner Truth had been saying earlier, which did not come until 50 years later in 1920 with the 19th Amendment. And Fuller was unafraid to name the ways that in the 19th century, she said explicitly and shocked Emerson, women are slaves, first to their fathers and then to their husbands. But more radical than speaking boldly about women's rights was the pamphlet she published in 1845 titled Women in the 19th Century, which even negative reviewers agreed was the first significant work to take the liberal side of the question of women's rights since the days of Mary Wollstonecraft, who wrote A Vindication of the Rights of Women in 1972, 50 years before Fuller. Fuller wrote, "We should have every arbitrary barrier thrown down. We should have every path laid open to woman as freely as to man. And there is no wholly masculine man and no wholly feminine woman." She refused to be confined to that so-called women's sphere. By this time, Fuller had also been hired as a literary editor of the New York Tribune, a daily newspaper with more than 30,000 subscribers daily, but also many more if you count the weekly subscriptions. And when she traveled to Europe, she was allowed to continue her weekly column, becoming, with no real ado, America's first female foreign correspondent. Fuller would deliver 37 letter dispatches to the front page of the New York Tribune from 1846 to 1850. And although I have not had time to detail the heartbreaks and the romantic ups and downs that Margaret Fuller experienced in her life, it's essential to include that while in Rome, that city she had grown to love through her childhood education in the classics, she met Giovanni Assoli, an Italian man aged 27 to her 37, fell in love, had a child, and later married. She took about a year or more before she told her mother that she had had the kid. Tragically, Fuller, Assoli, and their almost two-year-old son died in a shipwreck. Laura mentioned this earlier. They were only 300 yards from the coast. Margaret couldn't swim. Maybe that also has to do with what women were taught to do. And if she had been taught to swim, she might have still be with us or have had much more. We also lost her manuscript that she had written during those years in Rome, was also lost. Fuller was only 40 years old. She was at the height of her powers and potential. Immediately after her death, Emerson joined with others of her friends to write what became the first best-selling biography of Fuller, The Memoirs of Margaret Fuller, a Soli. On this Mother's Day, we can remember that Fuller did become a biological mother, but it easily could have been otherwise. And either way, she was and continues to be a mother and a midwife to the women's liberation movement, to the transcendentalist thought that continues to flow into Unitarian Universalism today, challenging us to be open to spiritual experience outside of what is sometimes allowed for in Enlightenment rationalism alone. There are many ways of being a mother. And the stories that we tell matter. Too often, our culture still tells the stories that Fuller advocated against way back in the 19th century of, boys can do it if you only think so, but girls can't do that, or if she knows too much, she'll never find a husband. How many girls have you seen that were brilliant in elementary school and sort of they start to dim that light in middle school and high school? It's a tragedy. But even when we hear those stories, the invitation is to turn them around, to reverse them. Yes, the Southern Baptist congregation of my childhood sometimes told the stories of women's equality. But to emphasize that would be to forget the stories of those strong, amazing women that were also part of that congregation, even as we need to also advocate for gender equality. Tell those stories and also advocate for gender equality in all areas. What stories have you been telling that might benefit from some work, from a new perspective? Is the story true? And what is the deeper, fuller story underneath that story you've learned to tell about yourself, others, and the world? How might you perhaps fruitfully turn that story around? As Unitarian Universalists, we can choose to tell ourselves and future generations the stories of our forebears like Margaret Fuller, whose struggles and successes in the face of gender discrimination challenge us to likewise advocate that every arbitrary barrier be thrown down in whatever form that looks like to you in your life or with those you love, that each individual may have the freedom to reach his or her individual potential and fullest potential. Fuller was rightly not satisfied with merely being free in her mind. She demanded that she and all people be free in action and in life. As she once wrote to Emerson about his proclivity to sit in his armchair in his library and just think thoughts, she said, "Oh, these tedious, tedious attempts of you to learn the universe by thought alone." Or she later said to him directly, "You are intellect, I am life."